Welcome to the Amateur Skeptics Podcast, number 313. I'm your host, Brian. Join me this evening, Mac.
I think it was Descartes who said, incognito ergo sum, which roughly translates to, I don't think they can see who I am in this fake model.
Mad Cat is here.
Right. Hello, hello. Breaking fingers, not breaking my toes.
Breaking fingers and hearts.
And of course, the dumbass himself.
Oh, such a great introduction, Brian. Who's a good podcast host? Who's a good podcast host?
Are you going to scratch me behind my ears, too?
Oh, you scratch my ears.
Yeah, do that. It makes
Brian,
you
Brian, you
that
know
thing.
How to pant. You.
Oh! Yeah. You don't have to give away all my secrets.
No, I don't.
Yeah, don't pants him on the air.
Pants on the air? He pants himself on the air.
How's everybody doing this evening?
Doing pretty good.
I am mostly upright.
I am moving crud.
And I guess we're streaming tonight, potentially. We don't know what they're hearing. They might just be hearing Mad Cat.
No one said anything to me yet, but I'm guessing that some people might be listening to this. They can't really watch it. And
let's just assume they're wrapped.
And entranced with our conversation?
Yep.
Really? Are we entranced with our conversation?
Not yet, but we will be.
I'm always entranced with my conversation.
We've got plenty of good things.
I enjoy the pleasure of my company.
Yeah, so I see that.
If you like sex and robots, this
pleasure.
Is the place to be.
Okay. Everyone's ready for it?
Yep, we're ready for it.
We're
ready.
Yep,
we're ready, yes.
What you time? Sounded? Yeah.
Yeah, what time
yeah,
is it?
You're excited. Come on. It is time for Brian and Dumbass's Masturbation Moment, brought to you by the Dumbass Media Empire.
The Amateur Skeptics present Ian's Masturbation Moment, brought to you by the Dumbass Media Empire. The Dumbass Media Empire, bringing you content that touches people while they touch themselves.
What is it?
Bringing you news without any clues?
Well, there's that.
I thought it was bringing you all the news. You.
No, it's something about bringing it but no,
down to your
remember.
Kinky paradise.
It's in the. That's why it's we have the bumper, so we don't have to remember. You know, bringing the news, you know, makes you want to touch yourself. Something. Remember what is it, dumbass?
All the news you can shake a dildo at?
It's a good thing we have it. It's in the bumper.
Well, it's a good thing that I don't want anybody else.
We got three things. We got three things.
Yeah, we do have three things in this section. We're doing good tonight.
The first one is one I found going through like a yes, no, maybe list. I was reading through one of those, and I saw praise kink. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Nope.
I think they
Bad
have
Girls
insert.
Bible.
This is a great site, too, by the way. If you're looking for naughty stuff, the Bad Girls Bible.
Is it?
Sure is. So
I can't publish my most intense and wild sex tips online, so I send them in my private and discreet email newsletter. Find more here. Find out more here.
Oh, I thought you were confessing something.
Not today. Not today.
So praise kink.
Actually, none.
The idea is something also known as affection play.
Affection play.
Yeah. So
kind of like cuddling.
I guess it would be kind of but in that you would the dominant would in some way.
So like cuddling, but saying you're a good cuddler.
I guess yeah. I mean, I think that would be the kind
or
of things that you might do. Of course,
the best
this
cuddler.
This being a kink, you know the you know it'd be something that the person is in order to.
I thought that was fetish.
Is it fetish? Is that the fetish? What is the
difference? That's what
I
heard. Fetish
get
is
on.
The thing that you need to get off, and a kink is just like something that you like.
Okay, so maybe that's true. So it's just something that adds the.
Yeah.
But it says okay. In fact,
in this one, so I'm kind of curious.
It's
about,
right
like,
here. It says in fact the difference between a kink and a fetish is the sexual a kink is an important or even necessary component to sexual pleasure and arousal.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I've heard the opposite.
Yeah, I've heard the opposite too.
That fetishes are more necessary and kinks are more casual.
It doesn't actually. What's interesting is that it gives us a definition of kink here, but not a definition of fetish. But yet it declares that there's a difference without telling you what the difference is.
Right.
Okay. So the article isn't fantastic. I apologize.
I had heard that fetishism takes it to a whole new level where you actually kind of make it its own thing. where it becomes where the fetish is more important than the person on some level.
I don't know that it has to go to that extent, right? Okay, it links us to a
easy orgasm solution site.
It also lists definition.
Well, I know certain, especially bondage interests, can get to the point where they're very consuming, as in, like, it's a lifestyle.
Yeah, so that would be like a lifestyle submissive or a lifestyle dominant, and they include those kind.
Yeah, I think there's a really famous book about it.
Would it be Twilight fan fiction?
No, it's of human bondage.
Wasn't Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance?
Wait a moment, you said human bondage.
Yes.
Well,
never mind, I don't want to know.
Anyway, so I just threw this in here because it was something that I happened across that I sounded interesting, but the idea is that the dominant would praise, and there's different reasons that the submissive might find this. It could be a humiliating factor within that they don't like the praise, and so in some way praising it would be because it's
well, especially if you're going, good girl, suck that again.
Right, yeah, kind of like our intro, right? That's who's a good podcast host. I knew where he was going.
Yeah.
But it could also be kind of a caring thing. You know, some people get off on that.
Exactly.
I know, like, certainly in, like, DDLG circles and stuff like that, that can be a thing.
So it talks about the different reasons that people might be interested in this. It says early experiences, maybe they didn't get enough praise. It could be a nurturing thing. It'd be lag if they feel like they're being they don't get enough recognition in the rest of their life. So that might be why they want to incorporate. They say love language. There's a book about love language we should talk about sometime. The love languages stuff goes into a whole bunch of garbage. But there is some utility there, I would say. But the idea of the love language is the book that it comes from.
It doesn't call itself garbage. You call it garbage.
I'm calling it garbage. Yes.
So you want to air more garbage?
No. Well, I mean, a lot of times
Brian,
our purpose is to dispel.
Brian thinks the book may have a humiliation.
That's right. I'm helping it out. I'm just giving it what it wants.
Being a bad book. Oh, spread those pages.
You were on ESO nowadays, because you would not be.
It talks about how there's not a lot. You know, there's.
Hold
not,
on a second now, Brian. I guess my question here about this whole praise kink thing. I guess Caesar did not have a praise kink because his friend came not to praise him, but to bury him.
His salad?
That was a different guy. That was actually crafted by Sid Caesar.
That joke might have been a bit of a strike.
Surprise, surprises.
So it goes into why a dominant, you know, might enjoy doing this well. But, and then it talks about whether there's any dangers to it. And basically it comes, the end result is that basically this would not be something that it would want to use. Therapy. That's not what. If you have a serious psychological condition like that, this is not going to that would require therapy. So I like that it talks about doing it safely. And I imagine that, you know, there are fetishes that have way more harm. But then, you know, then in the bottom, it has a list of things they just. And a lot of this seems like stuff you might say to your partner.
Hopefully.
Some of it.
Yeah.
How about like this one? I'm careful about this one around the office. Thank you for that incredible blowjob.
I would save that for not in the office.
Yeah, not in the office. Yeah, probably not a great place for that.
But if you've got a smart fan, it's okay.
Just put it on a cake and put that out in the office for everybody to have some.
You can you can really take a spanking.
Thank you for that great blowjob, Tanya.
Yeah, definitely.
Mind David.
Oh, God. If any of the gang from the ESO group are listening to this, I think that's going to be a joke for them to use, unfortunately.
You're so huge. Just like
you
that.
You listen so well.
Good. Now faster. You can really take a spanking. I there's some humor here if used properly. But I can see where this, you know, innate thing might be. So, yeah,
who's
so
my
fun.
Beautiful girl?
You know?
Hey, girl. Who's my beautiful girl?
Yes,
you.
You know, Brian, it's like the crane kick. If do right, no can defend.
Yeah, I think the crane kick is actually probably a terrible kick, actually. Actual.
Ooh, 91 dirty things to say to a guy.
Yeah, like I say, this site has a whole bunch of.
That should be interesting.
I thought
and
it was
number
interesting.
Number one is that thing about the crane kick.
All right, dumbass, what do you got here? You have one about the actual psychology of masturbation or
no, masturbation may protect against passage.
We've talked about it before. Animals. In last week we talked about specific.
Yeah, this
things.
Is a little bit of a continuation of what we talked about on last week's show, because it's bringing up a new discussion of like what the evolutionary factors of what leads to masturbation. I do like how in this article there's this one line here that stroking one's own erogenous zone is likely an ancient pastime that was passed on to all primate groups by an early common ancestor. And I'm just imagining they're singling out one primate ancestor just sitting on a log there, looking at it, like, and
his name goes up. His name was Og Jones, but
I suspect it goes back even further than, I mean, because there's got to be forms that felt good to prior to even them being primates.
It seems go ahead.
One of you.
Go ahead, Kaz.
Not all primates indulge in masturbation, but it seems like that it's been a convergent evolution thing in other species, because they mention studies in ground squirrel. Is it a particular type of ground squirrel? African ground squirrel. They engage in post-sexual masturbation.
Okay. And I guess
there's discussion on whether pre-sexual masturbation or post-sexual masturbation, what their purposes might be, like, of course, for flushing out passages, if it's post-sexual.
Right. If it's pre-sexual, the idea that you would be flushing out maybe dead sperm so that you're more potent.
Mm-hmm. So iguanas do it, too. Iguanas masturbate.
I think a lot of
and
species
And macaques have been caught red-winged with sex toys.
That is my favorite line in the article. The macaques being caught red-handed with sex toys. Mm-hmm. That makes a wonderful.
Right. The article points out that there has been less study on female arousal and masturbation in the animal. And that's a thing I think we should get on. Scientists, peep in on those female masturbating animals.
All they have to do is get a whole bunch of bonobos.
So, I mean, it's saying that they have noted masturbation in, 105 species of primates? And I don't know.
Probably.
Dumbass, do the scientists not know about Pornhub? It's a reasonable question.
Well, that's just that's just apes, though. That's just apes. That's not, that's a specific type of primate.
Yeah, but he says that the scientists haven't been studying female masturbation. I'm just asking, do they not know about Pornhub?
I think they mean specifically in primates.
Or in any animal. Like, it says here that most of the masturbation that has been studied has occurred in male animals.
Because it's easier to catch.
Well, partly because it's easier see it in males. It's more dramatic change in pace. But there hasn't been all that much looking for it in females, and that's what it's pointing at.
I think that's interesting. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Nope. I'll do it.
We've cut you off a couple times here. Go ahead.
Yeah. It also says that before, this suggests masturbation may somehow be increasing chances of fertilization in competitive sexual scenarios. While how is still not clear, one theory propounds it may improve ejaculate quality by expelling stale sperm first.
Yeah, so that would be pre-sex masturbation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the article we read last week suggested the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Although, for what purpose it plays. And that's one thing, I think I said this before, does this really need to have a purpose in females? It's a byproduct.
A byproduct of, oh, honey, you're so good. 2 seconds, great.
A byproduct of our biology.
And it does make me wonder, though. I mean, are we not studying it because we haven't observed it, or have we not observed it because we've been so focused on masturbation in male primates?
Or it could simply be the factor that an awful lot of sciences go towards the male side, and they don't even use the women.
Well, that's what I'm suggesting.
Case in point,
yeah.
For pregnancies and such, why would you use a guy for that?
It's so interesting, though, that we have such a misogynist. The focus in a lot of male focus and like drug testing and stuff like that, and it was harder to do in women because of their cycles and stuff like that, so they just didn't do it. But it means that the reactions that they might have to a drug or something over the years has been a problem. We do, and so I think that they the practices have gotten better. right, over the years, but there's still a particular bias that needs to be dealt with so that they're doing research in a more uniform way.
And if it's a female form of anything, they should be doing the studies on women instead of men. You know, it's like I said, studies on male for pregnancies. Why?
Yeah, it says, so when they're talking about the masturbation, they say neither of these tendencies, however, were observed in female primates. So there must be some, but it doesn't, seem to be connected with either, you know, pre-sex or post-sex. And maybe that makes sense too. Maybe, you know, that because, well, and I think that, you know, we definitely know that it happens, bonobos, right? Female bonobos, for sure.
Yeah.
So
they both do it. They just don't put them on view for people because, you know,
but there's,
they're always.
Yeah, there's a data bias, right?
Mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah, but yeah, it's more. I mean, it does back up a lot of what we talked about.
True. And Brian, what is the difference between sex and love for men?
Well, this is an interesting article that I happened to. So there is a lot of cultural myths about male sexuality, I think, because we see it in stand-up comedians, we see it in, you know, when people are colloquially talking about men, sex and love, and it a lot of it is not right. And as we do more and more research, that it's not as different as we think it is between men and women, and that it vary, and that the between person to person, there's a lot of variance, right? So you can't say men are like this, women are like this, because when we start looking at the actual data, there's a lot of differences. There's too much nuance in different people. And I think also, I don't think this article quite gets into it, but I think at different points in their life too, they might be that men and women, as they go through their life, are looking for different things from sex as, you know, as they go forward. So there may be times when they are just looking to get off, but there also is probably a lot of times where men and women are using sex to get closer with. And the data that they were looking at here suggests that there isn't as much difference between men and women as they would like us to believe. There are some differences, right? But it isn't as great as they want. So it starts out that the understanding of sex is wide and diverse, and is not simply gender. So I'm trying to
unpeak. You know, to simplify, Brian, men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
When we talk about garbage books, right there you go. this idea of that, how women are, and even worse, since you got me started, is a book called The Rules, which is an arbitrary set of rules for women about how to act in a relationship, right?
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Oh my God, it is so terrible. And the thing about The Rules is that it's how you get the man, but then you got to continue to do that for the rest of your life, because that's how you got him, right? So you have to continue to behave in this. Oh my God, The Rules is bad. So anyway,
if they don't like the icing, they're not gonna care about the cake.
Yeah, so the first part of this, they're talking about the key pieces of research that they've looked at, and they're looking at the brain, and they find that so when they show sexual images to men and women, they both get aroused. But one of the key differences is that the image that got a man aroused initially may not get them aroused the next time. That men may require new experience. Simply put, the most intense sexual desire for men might be rooted in new sexual imagery or fresh experience in a new partner.
There was a movie I watched that called it New Cow Theory.
Called it New, what is it?
New Cow Theory.
New Cow Theory.
How bulls only tend to get aroused if...
Okay, so yeah, so that, I mean, that's, this research would be supporting that as well. So new experiences, and where... They don't specifically say it, but it sounds like that women may not have quite, they might not say it's quite this. So here's some research, 2001 review. This is 2001, combined the results of 150 studies, did find that men were more, had more sexual thoughts, fantasies, and spontaneous arousal, desired frequent for sex with.
Frequency for sex was higher in men.
Male masturbation more frequent, and were more likely to initiate. So I think that we certainly. I still wonder how much of that stuff is cultural, right? How we've said women are like this and men are like this for so long that maybe some of that is becoming, and you stop saying stupid stuff like that and even out more. But maybe the female brain different.
I think there's some of that, but I do know that.
Things are changing over the years.
Women who are taking like testosterone tend to report higher sex drive.
Yeah, so that's interesting too.
I think there's something biological to it. I think it's probably a combination.
So yeah, so they talk about the three factors: lust, attraction. Attraction, attachment. So these are the three factors that. Then with these three stages, the brain releases hormones, and so now we're talking about testosterone and estrogen that are the effects on the. And so you know, they're going through, and they've got, you know, identifying the hormone. But I guess what the piece of this that I liked here is, so what does sex mean to men at different state, right? So they identify several differences. So sex is an affirmation. A man might you know, having sex with a woman they feel is more attractive than they are might give them a boost. Sex is comfort or connection. So a way to connect with partners. And then it talks about sexual infidelity here. And the interesting part about this, it says, when a man is unfaithful to his partner, many of the reasons why he might cheat can be tied back wanting to restart a relationship in the lust, where the phase of a high sex drive in occupying here is that it says that monogamy might actually be more difficult. They suggest that it's men, but it actually might be more difficult to hear it down here. People who have outside sexual partner probably likely to engage in those behaviors given the opportunity. But not everyone who is prone to these activities gets the opportunity. In fact, research suggests that monogamy isn't harder for men than it is for the reverse might actually. But it's a matter of opportunity. So that was interesting.
And of women being cheating hussies.
You know, Brian, has that ever happened?
Brian, you were talking about how there's those three phases of you know, you said there were
lust
and then attraction and attachment.
Yep.
But there's a segment of the population that can never experience the third one.
Attachment?
Yeah. It's forbidden.
Oh.
Being a Jedi sucks.
Or a priest.
Yep, saw that coming.
So they recap here. It says sexual experience for people is more generally used to confidently assert that men and women had different sexual natures. So sex means different. Did I read that right?
Yeah, you read that. Okay. Yeah.
But of late, that view is being questioned. Though as our understanding of sexual desire evolves, as a result, sex can mean different regardless of. So some people are looking for quick hookups. For hookups might be looking for affection and long-term
affirmation.
And long-term monogamy couples can find great comfort and connection after all those. But I think the bottom line is there is that the differences in sex desire in men is not as different as cultural beliefs. I found it interesting.
We're just complex.
And some of the data. So this says
August 6th, 2021.
Yeah, it's the last update. So, but they've looked at a lot of research.
Last medically reviewed.
But I found that interesting, and I think that that's something we've hit on over a lot of these. That the difference between men and women is not as vast a chasm as they.
And especially like anything in these kinds of measurements, it would most likely be on a bell curve, and there would be like a whole lot of overlap.
Yep, I agree. It's hard. It's difficult to do because it's. I think it's been harder to get funding for too. Right? So maybe not as well funded and researched.
Fair enough.
Yep. Let's move on. Let's do bird brains since Mac hasn't had an article yet.
Yep, I've got an article.
Bird brains.
So we've talked before about bird brains, about the fact that they've got vastly higher numbers than neurons of us. So they don't come up with sentences like they have higher numbers of neurons than we do per amount of brain matter, and that their brains are organized differently. And I believe we've also talked about the fact that they've got kind of a higher number of folds in their brain.
Now, does this account for their prowess in fighting pigs?
What?
No, that's only angry
birds. Green pigs?
That's only angry birds. What this article is about, though, is the fact that they discovered that not only do they have higher numbers of neurons, but the neurons that they have also utilize glucose at an extremely, a far more efficient rate than we do. And they're not sure if it's a combination of the higher body temperature and the smaller size or what it is. They haven't been able to determine why, but birds have, you know, essentially the brains use glucose a lot more efficiently.
They don't need as much.
they don't need as much to do what we do.
Right. Exactly.
It's, I mean, their brains are smaller, right? Physically.
Physically smaller.
And so having more folds and stuff like that probably helps to, seems to be needed. I mean, I know that for flight, flight is complicated. Flight.
I imagine the extra neurons would give them heightened ability to process that information. So,
I think the physiology of a lot of birds is pretty, you know, like, honed, like, towards efficiency, especially, like, any migrating birds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They actually know sight monikers, like the McDonald's. They'd be able to tell this mm-hmm. McDonald's from that McDonald's. And, you know, they also can figure out their north, south, west. They're better at their lefts and their rights than I am.
You know, I can tell you that migrating Canada geese can recognize mm-hmm. McDonald's and Carl's Jr. signs, and they mm-hmm. also happen to love French fries. So they will hang outside of McDonald's, Carl's Jr., what have you, hoping somebody brings out some leftover French fries.
Same with seagulls.
Yep.
So here's the question. So, okay, we accept that this is true, that mm-hmm. they're more efficient in using glucose than humans are. Why?
Yep.
They don't know.
They're working on it.
They don't know why. Their only theory so far is it has to do with the higher body temperature and the smaller size.
Okay. So there's less waste because they operate at a higher temperature.
Yeah. They have ideas about how it may work. Further study and testing is needed to uncover the exact mechanism explanation of how birds attain such a higher efficiency of neuronal processing.
How many species did they study for this?
I know they studied pigeons. I know that. And if pigeons have got it, you know, pigeons are, they're not the best at being birds.
until it comes to flying, which they're extremely good at. I mean, they're one of the fastest banking bird in the world, right? I mean, the way that their ability to take a corner is pretty awesome. A lotus would be,
I mean, they could take a corner. But, you know, they have to stay in the lines for the tellers like the rest of them. The only way they could bank faster is if they drove cars or got on.
Oh, hey, I saw one pigeon long time ago getting on the bus and waiting for it to get going. But the bus driver chased him off and he came back on and chased him off. He wanted a ride.
I love that. There's a comedian who told a story about how he was in line to get on an airplane. He was, you know, he's boarding the airplane and a bird got into the line and basically went up on board the plane and took a flight with him. And, you know, they didn't understand why he was laughing maniacally the whole time this bird is flying around the cabin and they're trying to catch it.
Oh, man. I saw a duck with ducklings and there was a really busy road. The mother stopped right at the stop sign and waited. Then the light went for them and they walked across on the walk sign.
Yeah.
And went over and everything. And she made sure all of them were over. And when they came back, they did the same thing. Just stopped when the stop sign was on and went when the green was on. It was quite interesting watching.
You know, we've got squirrels that do that in Denver as well. We've got... Mm-hmm. Apparently, the Canada geese up in Estes Park learned how to use the crosswalks, and then they taught mm-hmm. the moose. They taught the moose up in Estes Park to use crosswalks. I'm assuming, since both species have a foothold in Canada, that they have a language in common. It's probably Quebeco.
That is possible. I mean, you never know with geese.
I remember a meme from the beginning of COVID, back when they were doing stuff like putting circles outside of any store to show where you should stand. And there was one, like, a bunch of people standing in the circles and then a pigeon.
That is
so there's a store that I go to, Wild Birds Unlimited. I go there to buy safflower birds.
Mm-hmm.
When they had the COVID thing going on, they asked their customers to stay one turkey vulture length apart, one turkey vulture wingspan apart.
Okay, and they knew it.
Yep, they had a diagram. Turkey vulture wingspan is about 6.
Okay, that works.
Well, let's talk about an actual picture that was disqualified for being because they thought it was an AI picture.
AI
from a contest.
Yeah. That's right. We've been talking about AI for quite a while, but even before, like, the image generators and stuff were going out, we were talking about how much easier it was becoming and how, like, deepfakes are going to be a thing. And so, like, now that the image generators are out and they become so much better and stuff, there's all this suspicion over them. And I've seen this myself because I'm in, like, AI groups online. And, like, people often, like, bring in pictures that they think are, and they're like, ah, this is AI, and these guys don't even notice it. And the rest of them are like, no, I don't think that actually is AI. And somebody will find out, no, that was actually a regular photograph taken. And people just, like, get these ideas of what AI is and, like, any unusual or photograph in some way. But, yeah, this is a story about the woman who took the picture. Her name is Susie Doherty, and there will be a link in the show notes, or you guys can look up the information in order, like, you can get to find an article about it and the photo. The photo shows there's a it's in a washroom, and there's a guy, and he's holding the hand of a mannequin. There are two mannequins, and this photo was submitted to an art photo competition held by the Charing Cross Photo, a store in Sydney, Australia. And the judges were intrigued, but then they became suspicious that it was AI, and so they decided to ban it on the mere suspicion of it being AI. And what do you guys think of this photo?
I can see exactly where they thought it was an AI, because if you look,
it's definitely
back,
got a person. Yeah,
no, no, no. It has a personality of its own with the colors and all that other stuff. It's definitely AI style. However, the female mannequin in back of the male mannequin has a type of dress in which there is a frill coming out from the elbow down to the hand. If you look at the right arm, which would be on the left viewing her, the dress comes down and it looks like that part from the arm comes down in front of her dress, and it looks like the pink tile from behind her.
Okay,
that's probably what got them.
I'll tell you why this doesn't come across as an AI picture. They have hands.
True, and they don't have 14 fingers.
Not as big of an indication as they like the latest generation are doing hands. Okay, but I think like the latest version of Midjourney can do hand okay most of the time. Like I'm not sure exactly the percentage, but yeah, they still make mistakes. But, who's familiar with AI would be able to see a number of interesting things in this picture. For one, of course, like, the patterns on the clothes that the mannequins are wearing are very intricate detail.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think, like, an AI would manage that very easily. There's also the wallpaper. Yeah, the wallpaper on the wall, there's a pattern on that that's very regular. AI has trouble with that without messing it up. And also, there's a mirror in there, and it mirrors everything perfect, which AIs have trouble with mirrors and figuring what they need to put in there. It's like mirroring, it's even mirroring the pattern on the wall and
pattern
all
the guy's
all this
clothes.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And the other thing is that each one of those people, mannequins and human, only have two arms.
Yeah. True. Fingers, they have the correct number of fingers.
Exactly, the correct number of fingers. Yes. They only have two arms. This is not AI.
I think I'd look at the fact also that there are details in that AI wouldn't, like the vent at the top of the, I don't think that an AI would think that a vent in a bathroom.
Yep. Okay. They might not get that. Sure.
The soap dispenser.
I can see another reason they might have looked at it as an AI. I mean, between the tile and the wall with those funky party favor colored things up and down it, and the red sink and red table, and then the red stuff.
I think that if this is an AI image, it's clearly Photoshop.
Could have been, but it's not AI.
It's not AI, and I can see like it's got like a bit of a soft focus. AI sometimes does that in order to blur features that it doesn't want to like get too detailed on, and there is some sort of an odd perspective to this. I mean, it was just taken an iPhone, but it's got like it looks really cool. It's a very artistic photo, and like the colors match up and make a interesting visual, you know, splash on you. People are judging AI, like an art judge, I feel like, who's trying to judge whether things are AI or not, should know how to decide whether something is AI or not. They should have some sort of familiarity with AI and what it can and can't. Right?
I think, though, that's not fair. At some point, I think that a person is going to have to be able to have, to prove in some way that they shot the, right? In case these questions come up, because I think AI is going to get, as it gets better, it's going to be able to do the things that you're talking about, like the reflections and stuff like that. Where right now, that's problematic, but it won't always be. And AI is just going to get better. And like you say, already it is getting better. It can do hands and that kind of stuff. Okay. So I think that we need something else, right? Because as we get to the point where an AI photo looks just like a picture, we need something one step beyond that, whether it be metadata on the photo or something like that can verify for us. Because this photo was probably taken somewhere on a digital camera, and so they can probably show that the original picture has metadata on it. So there might be even longitude and latitude where the photo was taken, and some stuff like that you might not get from an AI photo. I mean, certainly they could fake it. But I think that those kinds of things could help to verify that this is a real photo as well. Just the camera that it was taken with, I think it helped.
I wonder if part of the reason they thought it was an AI also is that the sun's expression is so intentionally mannequin.
Right. And of course, to fit in the photo, it needs.
Yeah. I mean, he's playing mannequin, but there's an uncanny quality to it that might make people think that it was.
Plus, these mannequins are pretty damn good.
Yeah. Did get a couple of really nice ones. They do look like Daz.
They kind of look like Daz characters. Ones. Yeah, like they were photoshopped in.
I really like the fact that when they dressed the mannequins, they made some really unmannequin like. He's the one that's the most dressed like a mannequin of the three. The hair that the male mannequin is wearing and the glasses that the female mannequin is wearing are very unlike things you would normally
see. You know, it is interesting, and that's one thing I've noticed about the whole AI thing is it seems to make forget a lot of the time that Photoshop is still a very real and active thing.
Right.
And like one thing I just thought of is that, well, somebody could Photoshop together a photo that looks convincing, like it will have to be pieces of other photos and submit that to a photo contest. And is anybody looking up for that? It's just that AI is a big buzzword. But, you know, I often see in AI group people posting stuff that's obviously Photoshop, but they think it's AI just because it looks kind of weird or something. Somebody did some sort of weird Photoshopping thing with it. And it's like, no, that's just Photoshop. That's still a thing.
Yeah.
It's interesting though. I think that the lines are gonna see more of this stuff as.
Yeah, exactly the same as with the writing. Everything becomes blurrier in it. It gets better every year.
I want to talk about the robot tech. Let's move on to that one, if that's okay.
Yeah. Well, more about AI, this time driving AI. This is from Britain where they were... Actually, it says San Francisco, I guess. driverless robotaxi service is actually they're coming out in a lot of places. But there's a lot of questions about whether they'll be able to work... of course, people are concerned about safety issues and stuff and whether they should be allowed, but also whether they'll be, like, economically feasible. And we're going into that here because one thing about driverless cars is that they'll need more people on support in order to monitor things and, like, do other stuff than would be required by a traditional, like, taxi. So, like, will it really be saving money? Will this take off even if we get it to work properly? And, of course, there have been accidents with self-driving cars in the past. How is that going to affect things?
I still wonder, you know, one of the issues that we have is, when roads get sketchy, there's road construction and stuff like that, they're still not good enough to handle those kinds of irregular. They're fine on roads that are well-marked and stuff like that. But how are we going to get the cars to deal with, you know, some of these to be a taxi and to go everywhere, right? They're gonna have to go into some neighborhoods that are not well marked. How does that work?
I think the thing that amuses me here, Brian, is that you said that there have been some accidents with driverless.
I think there have been. Yeah, I mean, yeah, Tesla's killed a couple people.
I think I remember reading about the first accident with a driverless car. It had to do. I think there was some obstruction in the road that the AI just didn't recognize.
But were they accidents? Or were they bored robots?
They were controlled by framework.
Were the last thing the passengers heard? I'm sorry, Dave.
I don't know.
You know, I'll bet somebody's made a a GPS navigation voice under HAL 2000. Anyway.
Anyway, I don't know. I still wonder. I still think the technology's got.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if, on average, driverless cars get into, like, are safer than driver cars. But then that gets into a thing of like, well, who do you blame when the accidents happen? And that's gonna
that's a problem. And but there are, I mean, and we could probably look at them. Tesla has quite a few accidents now, right? I know that they killed at least one person. So it's only a matter of time.
Yeah, but that coincidentally, that person was an enemy of Elon Musk.
It's Skynet. That's what it is. It's Skynet.
Yeah, like from what I was saying before. Robotaxi services, and this is according to transport consultant Nick, they'll still need like customer support agents, fleet operators to monitor where the cars are and to troubleshoot problems the vehicles encounter, people to physically rescue the cars as need, clean them and charge them. It's like that's a lot of extra people that you're putting off stuff for, whereas with a traditional taxi, you just have like one guy who's in charge of it.
And his own money going into all that stuff.
So the question whether it's actually a good idea is, can this be actually economically?
Yeah, and I think the technology.
Well, serious question is does it cost more to run the AI car than it does to, you know, put drivers behind the wheel?
That's it. I mean, right now that might be true. It might not always be.
Oh, look at this new one they're making. New Origin autonomous vehicle will help making robo-taxi services profitable. It looks like a coffin. Yeah, it looks like one. Yep.
Yeah, it kind of does.
Yeah.
It also brings up the question, like, if you get into a car that doesn't have a driver's wheel or anything, like, that brings up the whole, like, you see these things in science fiction all the time, like, can somebody take control of that? And you just...
Skynet.
Yeah. Yeah, if the human has no way to gain control of the vehicle, how can that be abused, right? And if something goes wrong, what are the options? These are the things that make their way into science fiction movies.
Yep, absolutely.
Good options of put your head between your legs and kiss your ass goodbye.
Oh, I almost think we should end on that note.
Yay!
I don't know. It's just got a long ways. I just wonder about the actual ability of these cars and the economics, right? I mean, look at the development costs to do all of this.
Well, and then, you know, I know they've already had some autonomous trains, but
that's different.
You know, what if the train wreck that is our podcast becomes all AI? And then
that would be easy. They can get smart ass AIs, no problem.
Yeah, right. We're replaceable.
All of us are.
Yep. I have a lot of questions with these kinds of technologies. I think that they're years and years and years off. I think that developing is, I think that they have their uses. I think that trains are great for AI, right? Because they have a track, so they can't vary from the track. I think though, having a human with the ability to stop the damn thing, I think is still important, because getting it to recognize a human and stuff like that are still problematic.
Well, the other problem you've got is with an AI train, If you've got a bunch of workers who are not paying attention on one track, and then you've got somebody who is your best friend on the other track, you can't rely on that train to make a decision on that you're going to be satisfied.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing, as I think about it, my car has AI, but I am still better at recognizing when I need to slow down and speed up than the car is. Right, because I can look at the driver, anticipate what they're doing, what their next move is. My car can't, and until an AI can do that, can they ever be fully autonomous?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the problem is that if you get an AI to have as bad an opinion of the other drivers on the road as you or I do, then that AI is going to want to destroy humanity anyway.
That will bring about the end.
Put your heads between your legs, gang, and kiss your ass goodbye.
And then the rest of us just all become battery.
Ba-boom.
Let's talk about cochlear implants real quick here, because I think that this highlights that these implants are really just...
Cochlear implant?
It's almost a an allegory for a lot of different types of gene. I think that we can even apply this back to some of the autonomous cars. So you have these companies that they're building these cochlear, but at some point they become obsolete and they move on to the next generation, or they go out of business, abandon a product. And so this can happen. It doesn't have to be a cochlear implant. We saw this happen with there was an eye implant for people that were blind that allowed them. I think it primarily was a light sensor. People depended on these, and all of a sudden, you know, the people that depended on that device, the research, it was, you know, if they were part of a trial program, all of a sudden that stuff gets turned off. Mm-hmm. And this can happen with an implant as well. And this particularly happened in India. It's that, you know, they either lose their funding or something happens. And so these implants need regular maintenance, need updates. They have firmware, they break. They're an electronic that needs to be maintained. And if all of a sudden the one that you're using is is obsolete, and they start talking and they bring up the words planned, but planned obsolescence is in these kinds of technologies can be really detrimental to somebody, because if they don't have money to get the next implant, they may go from being able to hear one day to not being able.
So basically that plan is, ha-ha, screwed you.
Essentially, yeah. They say, we need a stronger term than planned obsolescence. We describe the profound sense of loss to people who cut off from these sensory
right,
worlds.
Because yeah, so when you don't have that sensory in the first place, it's really bad. But when it's cut off again, that really messes a person up.
Right, and so the idea that, I mean, it has to happen at probably a national level in order to prevent this from happening. And this story is coming out of India, but I imagine it happens.
Yeah, I read a story. I don't remember where it happened, but some woman who had to help her with it would warn her was primed to have one. She could make note and not do anything, go anywhere, drive or anything, and like. Just having that allowed her such an improved quality of life that she could go out and drive and have this thing that she could reference, and that they were taking it out of her because the company went bankrupt, or I forget if they went bankrupt or they're closing thing or something, they were stopping it and it had to be taken out of her. Just heartbreak.
Right. And so, and they're talking about how, you know, in cases where the corporations regularly introduce new devices and stop servicing old devices. And so the right mm-hmm. to repair becomes important because, you know, you want people to be able to repair their own device so that they can continue to use it if they get the net. And so, and we've been fighting for that just with, you know, people with their cell phones to replace screens and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge problem in electronics. But you think about it, okay, losing your phone is bad, right? We depend on these things. But imagine losing your hearing in the same way and not having the right mm-hmm. to fix your own.
It's
or your eyes, right? I mean, there could be all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it's text-to-speech, right? I use text-to-speech stuff all the time to get through stuff, to get through articles for the show and stuff like that. That's how I a lot of times I do it. So that tool is extremely important to me. Now that tool is pretty ubiquitous, right? It's built into Office now. I have, you know, a site online that I play with or that I pay for, you know, that integrates with different pieces so that I can use that. So you know, I can imagine that if all of a sudden all those services went away, how much more difficult it would be to do my job every day. Sometimes if I'm trying to get through an email, if I'm having trouble getting through the email, Outlook now has it'll read it to me. And it's gotten mm-hmm. so good that, like, different fonts and stuff like that, it can do different voices and stuff. I had one where Microsoft went through and it had different tones for different pieces of it. It was really good. There was probably some engineering in the background to make everything work, that other piece, but right. It worked, but it's gotten so much better. I would hate to lose that function. I depend on that in my Outlook. The dictation I depend on in my Outlook, you know, so that I can compensate as a, I can see where these cochlear implants for people that, you know, they got them as children, then, you know, they can hear, maybe they haven't learned sign language, which there, you know, there are communities that have issues with that. If you're deaf, they feel you should learn sign language. But if you have a cochlear implant, maybe you didn't have to. And all of a sudden, now you can't hear anymore. I mean, that I don't know. I find it scary.
Yep. It's losing language is very scary. Losing the ability to interact.
Losing a limb.
With the world is losing horrendous.
Yep.
What if you've got a limb that is supposed to do things that stops it?
Yep, sure. Same kinds of things. Yeah. So as we develop these utilities and give them to people, they should be maintained. They shouldn't be allowed to just stop functioning.
Or just stop doing anything with them to make them continue.
Well, but the problem is that if you've got a manufacturer, right, they don't want to support the same device forever. They want, you know, part of you know, business strategy is that, you know, you've got to sell the next thing, right? If you sell everybody version one, right, and you don't ever come up with the version two, how does your company stay in business, right? Is it just maintaining the old product? That doesn't make sense from a capitalist point of view, right? And we live in capitalism is what our society is built on. So for them, it doesn't make sense. They have to sell the new thing, right? They have to get people on version one to upgrade to version two because of the way that we've, you know, created our society. And so capitalism was part of the problem here.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So I know. So this article, you know, brings to light, you know, a problem that's not just, you know, imagine that you've got driverless cars out there now. And of course, you know, if you have a fleet of cars and they all of a sudden aren't supporting, you know, that model's no longer supported. Now you've got to buy a whole new fleet where a human could continue to probably drive that and operate until it actually was ready to be.
Whereas a human having an implant or an addition, like a leg, a limb, they don't have anything to back it up if they lose it.
Yep.
And have to buy more and more.
Yep, that's a problem, right? It's a huge problem without an answer. I mean, unless we find ways to fund these that aren't it, and you know, so the corporation can come up with, you know, they have the new thing that they're going to make money off of, and so they set up a way to rotate that everybody. But I think in the meantime, I think that, you know, support for these devices and the right to repair them yourself has to.
Yeah, that is paramount.
All right. Anything else?
Nope.
I think we should end on that discipline.
That is another autonomous car in the
kingdom. If you've made it this far, that's an hour of your time you're never getting back. But the amateur skeptics appreciate you giving that hour to us. If you'd like to tell us how you felt about spending that hour with us, let us know at WTF@amateurskeptics.com. The Amateur Skeptics Podcast is distributed under a Creative Commons Share Alike No Derivatives 3.5 license. Intro music by Peter Canold. Find more of Peter's music at soundcloud.com/PKANOL. Exit music by OFM. Find more of their music at myspace.com/OFMHQ. Artwork for the Amateur Skeptics by Sean Smith Ford. Copyright Shadow Knight Digital Portraiture.